Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Continuing the Conversation, a prevention podcast. My name is Allison Barden, and I'm the director of the Madison-Chatham Coalition, and we are so happy to present our fourth episode of this podcast series, and today we have a very special guest. We have Lori O'Brien, who is a licensed social worker and primary therapist at the Adult Residential Program at the Center for Great Expectations in Somerset. In addition to her professional role, she is also the board chair for the Madison-Chatham Coalition. So it's a special podcast episode today, and we're very happy to have Lori join us. So thanks so much, Lori. We're looking forward to this conversation.
Thanks for having me, Allison.
So why don't you start by sharing a little bit about what you do in your professional role, and then also maybe talk a little bit about what drew you to the work of the Madison-Chatham Coalition.
Sure. At the Center for Great Expectations, I work with women who are pregnant or parenting and who have substance use disorders and also co-occurring disorders, mental health disorders, who have also experienced trauma. And the women either have their young children and babies living with them in the program, or they're working on reunification with their children. So essentially, we are working not only to help our clients deal with the trauma that they've had in their past, but we're working with them to prevent trauma in the next generation.
So what initially drew you to the work of the Madison-Chatham Coalition, what, 3 years ago now?
It's two and a half, maybe closer to three. I guess when you see an issue that has such a damaging effect on so many people, I think it's natural to think about what can be done to not only repair and help recovery, but also to prevent it in the first place. So prevention is really key in this work that we do. And it really interested me when I first saw whatever you had posted. I remember just giving you a call and saying, I really want to get involved.
Yeah. And that started this relationship. Can't believe it's been almost 3 years. So yeah. We're so grateful to have you as our board chair. So now that we've learned a little bit about you, and you know what you do in your professional role, and what you do for the coalition, let's talk about our topic for today. So we are going to be discussing adverse childhood experiences and why they are relevant to the work of the coalition. So why don't you start by sharing what the ACEs are?
Yes. As you mentioned, the ACEs stand for Adverse Childhood Experiences, and they are potentially traumatic events that occur in childhood between the ages of 0 and 17. The concept started in 1985 when a young woman came in to join an obesity program with a doctor named Dr. Vincent Folletti. He worked at Kaiser Permanente in Southern California. It's a managed healthcare company. And he was working with this woman, and in about a year, she lost about close to 300 pounds. And then after about 3 weeks of reaching that goal, she regained about 37 pounds. And she's eventually able to identify that the weight gain began after being sexually propositioned by a coworker. She was, looking better now, becoming more appealing, I guess, to men. And she was able to disclose during the post-interviews by Dr. Folletti to find out what's going on here, that she had been sexually abused by her grandfather. So at that point, Dr. Folletti said that he understood that, child sexual abuse he thought was very rare. And then he developed a number of questions to try and understand why some of his other patients were putting on weight. And in one of those interviews, instead of asking his patient how old she was at the time of her first sexual experience, he inadvertently asked her how much she weighed at that time. And the woman responded that she weighed 40 pounds and that the experience was with her father. And so this information was surprising and disheartening to this doctor. And so this information led to the development of the ACE study.
That's how it came about. That's fascinating.
Right.
So what else can you tell us about this study? I mean, it was a large scale study, right?
Right. So it was conducted from 1995 to 1997 through Kaiser Permanente and the CDC. And what they did was they asked about 26,000 members of the Kaiser Permanente Adult Healthcare Program in Southern California to join. And they actually had over 17,000 that agreed to participate. And they asked 10 questions that relate to physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, physical and emotional neglect, witnessing violence, having a family member incarcerated, suffering from mental illness or substance use disorder. And the answers were all yes or no, and there were 10 questions. So if you answer yes to having experienced physical abuse and yes to having a parent who suffered from mental illness, your score would be 2. And that score doesn't refer to how many times you had the experience. It just, indicates that you had that experience. So it's really, however many you can say yes to out of 10.
17,000 respondents, you said, out of an initial total number of 26,000. So that's...
Yeah, about 26,000, I think they asked. And 17,000 said, yes, I'll participate in the study, which is actually a very high response.
Very, very high.
You know, it turned out to, be one of the most important public health studies that have happened, certainly, in the recent past, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So what were the findings?
They found out that, the ACEs are actually really common. They're prevalent and they also, they cluster. About 67% reported having at least one ACE score, saying yes to one of those.
So 67%.
Yeah, about 2/3 answered yes.
Wow. So that's an overwhelming response of yes.
Yes, absolutely. And, I've seen one in six had at least 4 ACEs.
Wow.
So, just a few, there's so much information that comes from this study. And just to give you an idea, you're about 7.4 times more likely to become addicted to alcohol if you have 4 or more ACEs versus having 0 ACEs. Right. The another thing that they discovered was that the ACEs have a significant impact on well-being in later life. So the respondents of the study, the average age was 57 years old, and the questions were all asked about, they were asked to answer about their own childhood, and then they were able to study what their current health was, and that's how they looked at this information. So what they discovered was that the higher the ACE score, the more likely one is to have poor outcomes in physical and emotional health, and possibly even a shorter life expectancy. The ACE score, it doesn't only correlate with substance use and depression, but physical conditions like diabetes and heart disease and COPD as well.
Have they been able to draw correlations between why that happens? Why a person who experiences an adverse childhood experience or has exposure to an adverse childhood experience early in life would then be more susceptible to health adversity later in life? Why is that?
Yeah, I know it doesn't make sense at first glance, right? It's like, how does essentially emotional traumas manifest in a physical way? And if you think about it, there are a few ways, actually. The first one is coping and learning coping skills. So coping is how children learn to deal with stress and adversity. And if a child is living with a parent or a caregiver that is suffering from mental illness or has substance use disorder or is, abusing them, then they're not going to learn the coping skills and learn how to understand a world that's predictable. Their world is very unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And like they have difficulty sitting in a classroom and learning. They have behavioral issues. A lot of children who are being tested for ADHD may be actually suffering from complex trauma as a child. They really present very similarly. So if you don't have a model as a parent or a caregiver that would help you to build these coping skills, then it would be very difficult for you to develop those skills on your own. And that really relates to how you're going forward and growing up and dealing with stress and adversity. There's also the concept of fight, flight, and freeze. So, you know, the way this is, you know, probably best explained, if you see an animal that you're afraid of, like a cougar or a bear or something, as a defense mechanism from when we were, early man was fighting these animals. We needed this as an adaptive system so that we could get food and eat and survive as a race. But at this point, if you see an animal that you're afraid of, your body sends a signal to your brain to release hormones like adrenaline and cortisol so that you can fight the animal or run from the animal, go hide and really regulate your breathing. So you're in a freeze mode, like don't move because you don't want this predator to get you. So it really down-regulates, these responses really like down-regulate the part of your brain in the front, the prefrontal cortex that is in charge of reasoning and decision-making and even like moderating social behavior. Mm-hmm. So if you're in this sort of hyper-vigilant state because you are under what we call toxic stress, you can imagine what it would be like if you were living with this wild animal, you know, if you had to go home to this wild animal, or if you thought that this bear could come out at any point, or you thought all people were potential bears. So positive stress or adaptive stress is different. You know, it has a more prolonged effect on your body. And then if you have a trusted caregiver and you have, you know, stress in your life of, you know, just regular stress, studying for a test, being nervous, am I going to make the team? Like that's normal. And even if there's even more serious stress and there is a trusted caregiver in your life that you know will help you get through it and, help you work it out, it'll all kind of end up okay. It's very different from what we call toxic stress, which is a physical response to the stress that changes the structure and the function of your brain. So even your dopamine receptors are altered, and those are the pleasure centers. And that would even help explain drug and alcohol seeking and early sexual behavior, which is one of the other correlations that the ACE study found.
So basically all of this childhood trauma that people are exposed to, it's happening at a time when the brain is developing and all of these coping mechanisms are being learned or supposed to be, you know, being learned in a positive, healthy way, and they're not, right? Because of everything that's going on. I participated in a conference and attended a session that focused on ACEs, and the presenter talked about how children that have exposure to ACEs act out or have behavioral issues or things like this, you know, in their adolescent years, like you're saying, as a result of a lack of coping skills. But he also talked about how it's so difficult for some people to get back to a baseline when they're in a very stressful situation. So they go from 0 to 100 without being able to regulate and moderate those feelings and how to process them. So I thought that was a really good visual.
It is. Absolutely it is. And, you know, emotional regulation is, you know, something we also learn from our caregivers and our environment. If you know, we have parents that aren't able to handle stress or take it out on you, or you won't learn that either. You won't learn how to do that. And that's really tied into communication skills, acceptance, and self-esteem. And you can imagine if a child is not only dealing with some of these adversities at home, but they also don't have the coping skills, the ability to get back to a baseline and regulate them, their emotions. And, you know, they may even have environmental factors, which are also an issue, poverty, isolation, premature responsibility, food insecurity, loss of a loved one, and, you know, even lack of support and supervision. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is that they're also more likely to engage because of these issues. And that's why we said there, you know, earlier that they're compounded and complex, because you know, when you have a child that's in that situation where their developing brain is introduced to toxic stress and their environment is unpredictable, and you know, they're not given, you know, proper nutrition, and they don't have the right supervision, and they're not doing well at school, and they're getting in trouble because they have behavior issues, and they're more likely to engage in health damaging behavior, smoking, substance use, early sexual behavior, things like that. So all of these things would put a child on a path to not caring for themselves, not physically, not mentally, not emotionally, and really, you know, finding themselves with an uphill battle, and one thing leads to another, and then this happens, and then, you know, there's a teen pregnancy, or there's a loss of a parent due to them not taking care of themselves. So they really all, you know, kind of cluster in that way as well, that one thing leads to another, and they end up being, you know, five out of the 10, I think, most common causes of death are related to the ACEs.
Wow. And when you talk about it that way, you know, and you start at the beginning and, you know, you think about the path that a person goes through in terms of development and different experiences that shape the person they become later in life, this is the time, you know, adolescence, early childhood, adolescence, it's when everything is developed and these healthy lifestyles, healthy habits, I should say, are developed. And if something is interfering with that, then of course, naturally, it's going to have a negative impact on that person as they grow up and then later in life. So,
right.
You know, when you talk about it like that, it certainly makes sense.
Right. And, you know, it's not so easily recognizable. A lot of these children will present as behavioral issues, ADHD. We spoke about freeze. That's not one that's spoken about as much as the fight and the flight. If there's a child who's not listening to you, they just won't do it. They can't, you know, I need you to come over and help us clean this up, and they just can't do it. There may be reasons that are not as obvious why that child isn't able to participate or respond in a way that you would expect a child of that age to respond. And it's certainly worth investigating, is really what this, you know, discussion is all about, is what we can do as a community and, you know, as a coalition to get the word out and to, you know, learn more about the effect that these experiences have on children growing up and then eventually adults.
Right. Just to summarize what the findings were of the study. Mm-hmm. So we know that they're common. We know that the ACEs are, they cluster. We know that they have an effect on a lot of different aspects of development, including coping skills, fight, flight, and freeze. And then there's also these environmental factors that also play a role and go along with exposure to ACEs. So basically, you've given us a lot of kind of scary information, I guess, right? I mean, it's especially when we talk about how they are so, you know, they're prevalent, as was found in the study.
It's scary because it's coming to light, but it's been happening. And I think that the more we understand about what people may or may not be able to do in terms of response or in terms of, you know, recovery or in terms of relationships, even, it would really help to, there's definitely room for repair, but the real work would be in prevention. Mm-hmm. I think the real opportunity would be in prevention. If we learn about these, the effect that these experiences have on a child, if there's anything that we can do as communities, as a society, as professionals in our daily life, and just as adults, if we can have an impact on their lives going forward.
There is some good news, right? There's a silver lining, not a silver lining.
Definitely. There's a silver lining to learning about it. They are preventable. The ACEs are preventable. It's best to do it from birth. And I think the more we recognize the intergenerational transmission of adversity and its effects, we can start to break the cycle. I think we talked about earlier how, you know, if your parents aren't able to cope, or if they have toxic stress, or they're not able to meet your needs, it's going to affect you and your experience of the world and your own self-esteem and capabilities and physical health and emotional health going forward. So we really have to support parents. Other parents, if you, you know, keep an eye out, if you see a kid who's maybe struggling, teachers can ask questions, and other coaches and other people who come in contact with children and teens. And for all of us, a good idea to help prevent this going forward is to tune into how you handle stress and how you react to stress. I mean, if you're hotel room's not ready, are you slamming things around and screaming and yelling? And it causes a ripple effect. And certainly your children and other children around you are watching this. This is how adults handle stress. Okay. And also learn to practice and build resilience in children. And one way to do that, and this is for parents or other adults who come into contact with children, friends, just anybody who can be a good role model for good communication skills, to encourage a constant narrative with children, to really try and get involved with their interests. I know there's a meme that's coming to mind about parents and what they'd rather do than listen to their child drone on about Minecraft, because it's very difficult for parents to get interested in that. But, you know, if you're not interested in that, say, oh, tell me, you know, why do you love it so much? What do you love about it? Or, you know, tell me about your friends that you play with, or, you know, there are questions that you can do, even if you don't share the interests. Reading to kids, incorporating rituals and traditions that give structure and predictability. So, you know, it doesn't have to be something expensive. It can say, you know, every Saturday morning we go on a family walk with the dog. Just something that kids can count on all the time, and, you know, really set a structure in place that helps them to understand that, you know, they can count on something. Because that's really the last point. Let kids know who and what they can count on. And, you know, be as consistent as possible and know and be intentional about it.
That session that I referenced before that I attended at that conference that focused on ACEs, right. The presenter talked about how every adult, all adults play a role in the prevention of adverse childhood experiences. Yeah. And that it really resonated with me, you know, primarily in my role as the director of Madison Chatham Coalition, you obviously know, but for our listeners, we focus on primary prevention. So, you know, we're really looking to reduce and prevent underage substance use. And we talk a lot in the coalition setting, we talk a lot about protective factors and risk factors. So I guess my question is, how can this information that you've shared so far, and, you know, you've talked about ACEs being preventable as well, if we pinpoint that even further, how can this information help us to prevent substance use, particularly in teens who have had exposure to ACEs?
First, I'd like to say that addiction can actually be the attempted solution for kids who have experienced childhood trauma. So if they come in contact with substance use or any other, you know, practice that would help them to not feel like, you know, overeating or cutting or self-harm. But substance use can actually be the attempted solution. So what they're trying to do is they're just trying to feel better. They're trying to feel better. They're trying to cope. And they've been holding on and in this hypervigilant state for, you know, as long as they can remember. And now they're being offered something that makes them finally be able to, like, sigh a breath of relief. And it's going to be difficult to let go of something. Actually, Dr. Folletti says, I know he said, it's difficult to stop doing something that almost works. And I love that quote because I think it really sums up what addiction is. And, you know, another thing that we can do to prevent substance use in teens is try and get rid of the stigma. I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, Dr. Felitti with the ACE study, he received a lot of resistance from people who thought that no one would admit or discuss their trauma. Mm-hmm. So the reason that people were so, he was so surprised that they were admitting it and talking about it. And, you know, it was really because in his practice, he created a safe and trusted environment. So there, any adult that comes into contact with children can try and create a safe and trusted environment. And it might not be the right venue or situation to talk about everything, but to learn about some of the services that are out there that people can get referred to, mm-hmm. and to really become well versed in that. And we certainly have a very easy access to that with the coalition.
Right.
So then certainly developing systems for primary prevention. So that's education, that is, you know, environmental efforts, that is working with law enforcement, and so working with, you know, local government to put things in place that make it, put safety measures in place, put, you know, warnings in place. One of the things that, you know, that we do is the sticker shock at the liquor stores, to put little stickers just reminding people that, you know, there is a drinking age and it's illegal, just a little bit extra mm-hmm. Effort put forth. And also to use screening tools, like in the medical profession and other healthcare settings, use screening tools. Even in schools, there are ways to make sure that kids are safe, and to, you know, talk to someone about it who maybe knows how to report it in the proper way. But just to really educate yourself and to know services are in place in your community. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I'll just say our model with the coalition, the 12 sectors, we have 12 sectors working together towards preventing teen substance abuse and preventing the causes of teen substance use. And the way we do that is we have youth serving organizations like the Y. We have Project Community Pride, athletic teams. We have lots of arts and dance and, you know, drama, scouts, clubs, all of these. It's a very active community in Madison and Chatham. We have, you know, all of our church and spiritual organizations. There's a really, really active community here. And all of those people who obviously care a lot about the community and about the families and the children can benefit from learning about this whole concept of trauma and ACEs and the effects that it has on kids and adults in later life.
I think also when we're talking about preventing substance use, you know, as the coalition does, and, you know, from your perspective, your clinical perspective, talking about preventing ACEs, it's just so similar. There's so many of the same strategies that can be employed for both, for the prevention of both, and they really do go hand in hand. You know, one thing that came to mind when you were talking is, and particularly about sticker shock, and when we focus on underage alcohol use, you know, as a coalition, we're always trying to promote social norms, right? So social norms around substance use. But when we talk about ACEs, one way to prevent ACEs could be promoting social norms that protect against violence and adversity, right? So if mm-hmm. a child is exposed to something like that, if a community is promoting social norms and the child sees these social norms as opposed to what they're seeing in their home, then that could lead to, you know, hopefully that leads to the prevention of that ACE from occurring. So many of the skills that we teach also, you know, another strategy that we use as a coalition is providing support and, you know, with, through parent programs and things like Hidden in Plain Sight and other speakers that we have come in. It's about teaching skills and making sure that people, that adults and teens have the skills that they need to make healthy choices. So the same can certainly be said for ACEs. Connecting youth and teens to caring adults and activities. That's another strategy that, that we use, whether it's by working with the Y and collaborating on a family event or a teen event. You know, it's things like this that, you know, we're making those relationships for teens so that it really does help them to make healthy choices as they develop. So really the two do go hand in hand. And I just thought about that as you were talking about the prevention strategies. So
absolutely. It's very connected.
Yeah.
And it's really about, you know, kind of tuning into what's going on, and I think communication with children is a really important tool. I mean, there are coaches out there. There are, you know, talk to kids and say, you know, hey, how you doing? There's such busy lives going on, and people are rushing, and you know, we have to get a lot done at this practice or at this dance class or this, you know. But don't forget to, you know, really just say, you know, it's okay to say like, hey, how are you? Like, how are you doing? Are you okay? Like, everything good? Yeah. Okay. And really they might not be able to answer right away, but if you show an interest, and, I think it's Josh Shipp, he says one caring adult is the difference between, you know, a successful child and I guess, and I don't know how he really laid it out, but it's true. It's, you can really have an impact on a child's life if just by even modeling a different way that they know that they would like to learn more about and you know, hopefully eventually be able to ask for help.
Right.
I want to make sure that we don't end this conversation without making it really clear that experiencing adversity in childhood is by no means a guarantee that you're going to be unwell as an adult. There's a high correlation between ACEs, especially multiple ACEs, and physical and mental unwellness, but they are risk factors. And some of the protective factors that we discussed are certainly been shown to mitigate some of the unwellness that follows the adverse childhood experiences. And the more that we understand how trauma manifests and how we can identify, especially at a younger age, what trauma looks like, and the more opportunity we have to start focusing on wellness. And this conversation is definitely part of what needs to be happening right now. I think especially to the people who are not working perhaps in a field that would be focusing on it. This is a job for everyone.
You've shared a lot of really, really good information today. So if our listeners are interested in learning more about the adverse childhood experiences, and also what they can do to promote well-being in their own community, how can they do that?
Well, at first I would say is, you know, get involved in your community. You may not know what there is available to be done, but when I read about the coalition, I just called the number and I met Allison and here we are. So if you have an interest, there's usually an opportunity. So I would really encourage people to attend a Madison Chatham Coalition meeting, and, or, you know, if you're not in the area, another local drug-free community coalition. There are a few in New Jersey and plenty around the country. You can go to the cdc.com. You can learn about the ACEs. You can even take an ACEs test online and see what your score is. You can look at a YouTube video by Nadine Burke-Harris. And or you can even log on to the Center for Great Expectations, Qatari program, which is now offering a lot of videos for that talk about, you know, how to prepare for school in the pandemic and all different issues about, you know, parenting and trauma and stress that are really, really helpful for everyone.
Also, I just want to mention, you referenced this before, but ACEs, you know, this study was done when, in 1995, right?
Right. It took like 2 years.
Yeah, 1995 to 1997. And it's amazing how in the past, I'd say 6 months for, you know, in coalition work in particular, it has just been everywhere, this topic, adverse childhood experiences. You know, I've attended four conferences this year, and there has been at least one, if not more than that, sessions that have been focused on adverse childhood experiences and underage substance use prevention. So it's definitely gaining more momentum, but it's, you know, it's great that it's coming to light and it's getting the recognition that the study warrants.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are plenty of other studies that support this information. And it's not just the mental health field that is moving towards a more trauma-attuned model. It's schools and law enforcement and, you know, so many industries and sectors can benefit from learning more about this and incorporating it into their own work. It really does put another layer of understanding in how people are reacting. It's not really what it appears to be.
Right. That's exactly what I was thinking. It's, you know, even in the past few years with stigma-free communities and even, you know, at an elementary school level, these Be Kind campaigns, it's really all about just learning more about the experiences that have shaped people and children and why people, you know, getting down to the why behind behaviors and things like that. So when you think about it in those very broad terms, it makes perfect sense, right? That this is something that we should be focusing on. And from every single one of our sectors that every one of our 12 plus sectors that we engage in our coalition work, it's so important. So thank you so much, Lori, for talking with us today and for sharing all of this information. At the end of the podcast, I will also include information about the Center for Great Expectations and Qatari as well. So thanks so much, Lori.
Thanks, Allison.
To learn more about the original ACEs study, go to cdc.gov/violenceprevention/ACEs study. To learn more about the Center for Great Expectations and Qatari, go to cge-nj.org.